We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now. Soylent Green is people. I'm going to be your host today. My name is Russ, and I'm here joined by Dave Walker. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello. It is good to be here.
Before we get started talking about today's episode, which is going to be the ever-popular, critically loved, Loin Like a Hunting Flame, we'll start with, since this is your first time joining us on The Time Is Now, with the Millennium Group questions.
Cool.
Number one is, when did you first discover Millennium?
Ooh. I first heard about it probably when I was maybe 10 or 11, which is probably not the ideal demographic for the show. But it was kind of off the back of X-Files, as probably a lot of many people's stories will be. We had, like, over here in the UK, I guess, like, everywhere, it was just such a huge thing. And a VHS box set that I got of kind of, like, I think it was up to season 3 at that point. And every video started with basically the Fox TV spot for Millennium. And I was always kind of like, oh, what is that? The music's cool. The voiceover's like doom and gloom. It's got Bishop from Aliens in. I have no idea what that is. And then there was a trailer for Harsh Realm on it afterwards as well. And I thought that looked cool. And that kind of just disappeared into the ether. And then I think it was around second year of university. So I would have been 2021 when a friend of mine said that he'd seen it all and he lent me the DVD box sets. Man, I just didn't sleep until I'd finished season 1. It was nuts. It just sucked me in. Crazy. Yeah. So, yeah, 2021 sort of thing, around that age.
Awesome. Yeah, both you and I really got into it when the DVDs came out. I also didn't watch it when it was on its first run. That was a nice era of discovering television, the early 2000s.
It's kind of, when you're watching it, you feel like it's almost kind of like reading Lovecraft in that sense, that you're sort of looking over your shoulder like, am I supposed to be watching this? Is this okay? It's kind of like a forbidden tome sort of feeling to it, I think. And it holds up surprisingly well. And I'm rewatching it again now, it's probably been about 8 years since I've dug myself back into it. And I collect Laserdisc. I don't know if you've kind of got a heads up about my absolute fetish for dead formats, but a contact of mine in Japan recently sent me all 3 seasons on Laserdisc, which cost a fortune, but it now means that me and my partner are watching them kind of through sequentially, and she was really mad that I didn't watch this one with her, but, like, you know, I only had like an hour free today to watch it, and she wasn't around, sadly. But so we're going through them all again at the minute, which is going to be interesting, I think. Yeah.
Well, jealous of 2 things, that your partner is interested in watching Millennium, A, and not only that, is going to get mad at you for going ahead of that, and then 2, Laserdisc copies of Millennium. I used to have a Laserdisc player before I had to move so many times and just couldn't afford keeping it. But I didn't have anything as cool as that. When it comes to collectability, you definitely win this season, if not this year.
Yeah.
That's super cool. I didn't even know it was on Laserdisc internationally.
It's a Japan exclusive. When they finally arrived, the guy gave me an absolute steal. He's a fantastic contact in Japan. And he remembered I was specifically looking for him. It took him about 8 months. And I was still waiting on a couple of paychecks at the time, and he sends me a message like, yo, I just found, doing a house clearance, little old Japanese lady just had these Millennium Laserdiscs if you want them. I'm like, Christ, I have no money right now. And suffice to say, I had even less money once. I'd had probably weighed about 12 kilos, to get them shipped, plus the cost of the discs themselves. Like, you see them on eBay, like a set of five discs for $250 to $300 sort of thing, which is just stupid crazy money. Like, altogether, it probably cost me about $350, which still isn't cheap, but it's a holy grail find for me. It's to find something that, like Millennium, that is such a personal thing with me on a format that I really dig. So, yeah, it was a nice find, and she's big on Laserdisc as well, so we can enjoy that together.
That's fabulous. I hope at some point you can take a photo, if you haven't already, and share it in the Facebook group.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that art. Yeah, there's something about the box feeling when you get the Laserdisc boxes. I mean, the normal 12-inch-ish sleeves are cool, but that's a really great find. I shouldn't be encouraging too much consumerism, but I'm going to say you made the right call on that one.
I think encouraging consumerism on the independent secondhand market is perfectly acceptable. If it's directly feeding a family, it's all good, brother.
Amen. And it's also your archiving. It's not like you're buying something that was mass produced and spread around. I mean, how many copies of that are going to be left in the next 20 years?
Exactly. Yeah, I suppose that's the case. And due to the shipping cost, probably this is the first time the complete set has made it out of Japan, to be honest. That's an exaggeration, but you know what I mean.
Who knows? I mean, well, maybe another set made it to Chris Carter's house, so, and Henriksen.
Quite possibly. I mean, I like to get them signed by people at conventions, and you walk up to them with, like, you know, clutching this Laserdisc in your hand sort of thing, and you hand it to them. And I met most recently it was Paul McGann from Alien 3. It was an Alien 3 Laserdisc, but he was there kind of based on his Doctor Who credibility, and I just handed it to him, and he was like, what is this? I don't understand what this is. Is the soundtrack available? Like, no, it's Laserdisc. Like, I'm just going to sign this. I have no idea what this is.
Well, you got two good anecdotes that you've eaten. You know, you got the Laserdisc, you got to meet Paul McGann. Let's give it a shot for question number two, which is, what was or is your favorite episode?
Oh, I was thinking about this hard earlier because I figured I might get asked. I think the best episode that I've seen recently is another quite divisive one. It's not my favourite, but I think it's one of the best, is Well-Worn Lock. I can't say it's my favourite because I didn't mentally or physically enjoy the experience.
No.
But I think, in terms of breaking up the pace of Season 1, it's probably one of the best Season 1 candidates. You know, actually using the Catherine Black character as something other than to try and cheer Frank up at the end of the day kind of thing. It's a nice little thing for her. I'd like to see more of that, but I think because this episode is so unique in that aspect, Frank is just kind of faffing around in the background for a lot of it, which is, it's unusual for a show to do that, I think, and I just really appreciate that aspect to it. In terms of a favourite, I remember being a big fan of the Mikado. Again, it's another sort of episode that takes Frank Black's power away almost, and it is kind of standard Millennium procedural drama sort of thing, but because the goalposts shift so severely against his favour, it just makes something, it's another case of breaking up the flow, I guess, because when you've got these long, like, 20-24 episode seasons, it's kind of like, okay, here's something different for the mix. And probably by that logic as well, The Curse of Frank Black, I think that is a beautifully constructed episode. I think some of the acting is a little bit off. There's some really, really kind of over the top sequences in it, especially with the younger fella in the house. I didn't know people could smoke cigarettes that hard, that fast, with that much attitude. But you know, it's kind of, you know, it's fine. It's the '90s, and probably get the Behind Me Satan, or is it Somehow Satan Got Behind Me? Again, it's breaking up the formula a little bit, and it's inverting your expectations of the standard viewership, I think. If you were just tuning into it for the first time, you probably wouldn't know what the hell was going on. But if you're a seasoned fan of it, it's something that's kind of, it's almost like it feels like a personal in-joke between the writers and a dedicated fan, which I really love. Yeah. So those are probably my picks. I couldn't pick a specific one at this point.
This is a difficult show to do that. When I answer the questions, it's not only we love the show, I mean, that's one reason, but you say about anything, but I think Millennium is a show that tries to swing for the fences a lot, and that means there's a lot of hit or miss episodes and episodes I love that have flaws, and it's it's a tricky thing. But the pacing thing you described is one of the things I like about the show, which leads into the next question, is each season sort of has its own feel and tone that it upsets the balance. I like that it does that. A lot of people don't. But this gets into question three, which is, which is your favorite season?
Goodness. I think it might have to be, I know it's a fairly standard choice, is probably season one. I think it is the most generally accessible to be able to just sort of binge it back to back, or to be able to just, if I need my nice little depression fix or something like that, if I want to feel downbeat or if I want to get myself in a certain mood, like I want to cook some eggs real angry or something like that, I'll just dip into one of the darker episodes from season one. Season two and three, with their kind of establishing universe and mythos behind it, it's harder to sort of just dip in, even though it has its creature features and it's one-off episode sort of thing. There's more of an established arc that is trying to build somewhere, and it's just slightly less accessible. That doesn't mean it's bad. I don't like them any less. It's just, for me, season one kind of, it clinches everything that I love about the 90s. Everything rains, it's grey, it's miserable, all the soundtrack is just Yamaha synths that didn't cost very much money. It's the perfect sort of TV for me, I think, season one. Yep.
In case you probably haven't heard my answers, but I'm also a season one person. I think a lot of the fans, when I've just in fandom online in the past, I always thought season two generally gets the most. There are a few people out there who are season three supporters, such as Troy Foreman of Back to Frank Black. Uh-huh. And, you know, that he's got his good reasons, and I'm glad there are defenders because there's many things to like about that season. Yeah. But they're all good in their own ways. There's many reasons I like season one, but the tone that you brought up, the feeling, the atmosphere. The season two feels a little too cozy in X-Files at times, which I don't want to use the word too. It just feels more like the X-Files, which is great. I like the X-Files, but I love Millennium. not a knock. It's just a different taste, a different aesthetic. Yeah. So I'm agreeing with your point in my rambling. Question four, who was your favorite character?
Oh, bloody hell, I don't know. I'm not gonna say Frank Black, because that's basically like supporting your hometown football team. That's just not interesting topic for discussion, is it?
He's the best character in television history, so it's cheating.
Yeah. I think I am probably a Peter Watts fan, to be honest. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just my affection for Terry O'Quinn. Maybe it's the mustache. I don't know what it is. I think his three-season arc is probably, even though I think the group's story arc is somewhat mishandled and patchy, I think his is fairly consistent, and kind of the weight of the consequence of his choice in the second to last and the last episodes of season three, I think he kind of comes into his own and you're like, oh, that's pretty sad. Okay, yeah, I think Peter Watts, to be fair. I think that he's a nice mystery man in season one, just kind of in the background, and you're never quite comfortable with knowing who he is and what he does. His first couple of appearances in season one are treated with a lot of sort of portentous, or kind of, he feels like a character of ill omen, just kind of like waiting out in the street, looking at the house sort of thing. And that's kind of dropped towards the middle of season one. But I like the way he's set up, and the payoff in season two, that he is actually something a little bit more than a consultant. And in season three, I think that is a nice little arc that he's got. Yeah, I'll go with him.
Good choice, and well said.
Who's your favorite?
It's a tough one. I think I chose Catherine as my favorite. And that kind of goes back to what you were saying in Well-Worn Lock. Mm-hmm. And to not repeat what I said so much on the other one, but Well-Worn Lock, I think, does a good job in that it just flips it in the sense of Frank being a support for the work she's doing. Mm-hmm. But I generally just like the idea of having somebody so balanced as a sort of a philosophical sparring partner. Mm-hmm. and is supportive, empathetic. She gets a very little, too little screen time.
Yes.
But I think what she gets is really good.
Mm-hmm.
And her arc, and also just Megan Gallagher, just I think does a great job.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough one to actually say, is the character better than Watts? No. But I think without Catherine, the show would not work.
No.
She gets a lot of, I think, unfair derision without understanding why.
Yeah.
And that kind of gets to this episode. There's only so much time, and you can't. It's if this is not a 2-hour focused show, it's from an episode of the week style thing. And she just adds a lot of the necessary empathetic intelligence and general intelligence and reason and rationality outside of the world Frank's in to provide context to make the episodes make sense. So I dig the character.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I think quite a bit of the backlash that, you know, people, especially new people that are kind of coming to the show in the last 10 years, is that the comments I generally see are, well, she just kind of sits around at home and looks after the kid and gives Frank a pat on the back and, you know, fluffs his pillows at night sort of thing. That's not a euphemism, like, you know. she's kind of seen as this sort of passive character, which is just kind of like a stay-at-home mum sort of thing. But then, you know, you do get an insight into what she actually does. And I think there's a level of subtlety to it. But it's just not. It's just the fact that people aren't seeing it on screen reinforced all the time is that they're not getting what she, you know, the larger scope of her character, I guess, is the issue, yeah.
And that'll kind of get into some of the things I'm looking forward to discuss about this episode, but I think there's a lot of projection onto the show that's not necessarily fair, because I think, especially in season one, and season two, definitely, but season one, Catherine's shown supporting the plot in a lot of ways, external from the home and the homemaker role. Mm-hmm. Not just well-worn Locke, but as a victim consultant in blood relatives, things like that. I mean, there is the idea that it's contrasted where there's all those late nights where Frank's working when he shouldn't be and she's at home with the kid or vice versa.
Yeah.
But it's a fun debate. But I didn't like them going to that trope at the end of season one. But c'est la vie.
Yeah.
The final question is the hardest question. What is your favorite moment from the show?
Oh.
Or maybe it's not the hardest.
No, actually, I immediately have those in my mind. So I should give a tiny little bit of background about myself. Basically, I am a musician and composer for film, video games, TV, documentary, just anything with a moving picture. I write tunes for it. And as an impressionable student enjoying a lot of recreational drugs and taking Millennium in for the first time properly, this kind of the sounds of Millennium really influenced where I went and what I enjoy to produce for other people. And so the music's really got a special place, probably more than anything else in the show. Again, not saying I don't dislike anything about the show. It's just the music resonates more. And I think because of that, Paper Dove, the music at the end of that episode was just kind of, it felt like Mark Snow just really sort of pushing himself to the forefront before the series ended, before season two started. And it was great to just kind of hear that sort of come out. And it's one of those things that is just so 90s to listen to, with just the sampled synthesized violins and stuff. And yeah, just a real turning point in the show, the pace as well, when it gets, suddenly the story gets real personal kind of thing. That's probably number one. And number two is probably Goodbye to All That. Again, it's music related. And it took me like 5 or 6 years, not actively pursuing it, but kind of looking on forums every now and again. I was trying to find the piece of music for when Frank and Jordan are kind of silhouetted and they're running down a school corridor.
Yeah,
and they
drilling.
Yeah. That's it. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's my favorite song from the show.
Oh man, it's beautiful. And it's just kind of like it is that distinctive 90s piano sort of sound, but it's just such a it's got a heft and a weight to it, I think, that you know, Mark Snow's turnaround is basically, from what I imagine and what people have told me that met him in the 90s, he gets sent an episode and then he just writes to it in real time, and then he does a second pass with the synthesizer, and then it's done, it's out, it's ready to go on TV kind of thing. But there's certain moments where it's kind of almost like he worked a little bit later into the night kind of thing, and he really got something down, something really memorable, something really powerful. So I think those two moments sort of bring that across for him. And, you know, for, you know, when I was seeing it the first time, I was like, oh man, I need to get this music. And Drilling was, for, you know, like I say, 5 or 6 years, I couldn't find it anywhere.
Oh man, I didn't mean to jump in and like steal your thunder, but to get a shout out for that, because that was when I first finished the series, that moment. I mean, it would be wonderful to have a season 4, but running down the hall with that song was just an incredible ending. Yeah. So that's a fabulous choice.
Thank you kindly.
Both of them are great choices. Today, we're going to be talking about Loin Like a Hunting Flame. This is episode 12 of season 1. It originally aired in, looks like, January 31st, 1997. Had a Nielsen rating of 8.0. It was directed by David Nutter and written by Ted Mann. So just as a brief summary, this is taken from the This Is Who We Are .net. Frank Black and the Millennium Group sex crime expert Maureen Murphy are called to Colorado to investigate when a man's marriage failings turn into deadly sexual fantasies, attending local raves and swingers parties to track the killer. Unfortunately, the investigative pair find resistance in the form of a biased sheriff and a local law enforcement team unprepared to deal with such sexual attacks. Okay, before we start... How would you, in just a quick brief sentence or two and a rating, from 1 to 10, 10 being your favorite, or be objectively good or subjectively good, what would you rate this episode?
I'd say that it is, by the numbers and somewhat on the nose, in the same way that District 9 is a kind of a subtle sort of... commentary on apartheid. This with its characters is kind of, oh man, it's a bit of a sledgehammer. And I think Detective Thomas might be one of the most bipolar people I've ever seen on TV. And I would give it a 6 going on 7. I still enjoyed it. I still had a good time.
Wow, okay, you're much more kind than most critics. Okay, yeah.
What would your response be?
Well, and I'll get into the background of this, which will make it more complicated. If I had to really think about it, because I generally will put things on a scale of, so I have to weight it or evenly distribute. I like a smooth bell curve when I rate these things. So I would probably put it down around a 3. If I was going separate direction and writing, I would put direction at a 1, and I would put the writing at around a 6.
Are you referring to direction in terms of where it's going in terms of the season overall, or as in the actual directorial ability of the person behind the camera sort of thing?
The director and the editor, the actual craft behind it, yeah.
Oh, you savage.
Yeah, I don't mean to be so, and that doesn't mean they're the worst in the world. I just think of in Millennium, of all the episodes, I think it's the most, and to say poorly isn't the right word, but I think it does the script on almost every level a complete injustice. The script is not perfect, but this is an argument I'd like to explore, and we'll get into it, is that I think so many people, especially critics, and this is going to be a strong thing, but I'm going to say it, misinterpret what the script is saying because of mistakes made by the director. And it's not just bad in the sense of I don't like it, but in that it's taking a script that I think is trying to do something that isn't so sledgehammery and isn't so blunt, and then not only makes it blunt, but then makes it flip over so that some people interpret that it's saying the exact opposite thing that it's saying. And I think that's a big disservice to the writer.
I'm probably going to lean towards my 6 then, so we don't get too angry. I agree with you in a lot of respects. I just found it so massively bang average.
No, I don't think we're going to get in an argument, actually. I mean, I think our debate is going to be very friendly. Where it comes from, and I'm going to start with this quote, which to kind of give a little background of where I'm interested in going and whatever directions you want to go, let's play mm-hmm. around with this. I had read quite a few different critiques of this episode mm-hmm. a while ago, read Darren Mooney's review, and mm-hmm. I always enjoy his work. Every now and then when it comes to Millennium and things, I don't necessarily see eye to eye on everything, but he always makes great arguments, and he's, you know, it's always fun to read, and he's super mm-hmm. sharp. But then, I don't know if you have ever read Todd Vanderwerf's review of this episode.
I have not, no.
So he wrote for the AV Club with Zach mm-hmm. Handlin. They did all the X-Files and Millennium and recently published a book. Yeah. He opens his review with, "Loin Like a Hunting Flame is quite possibly one of the worst episodes of television I've ever seen."
Jesus Christ.
And now to kind of get down into this, where I am interested in exploring with you. So I read his review and I read all the other reviews and I thought, wow, I don't remember the episode being as bad as people thought it was. I remember having problems. Mm-hmm. I remember not loving it, but I don't remember. So I went back and I watched it after I had watched another episode to do for this podcast, and I was quite stunned that I thought, am I crazy that I am not seeing the same episode they're seeing? And so, mm-hmm. so I think this is one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this episode on the podcast. I think it's a nice litmus test in that there's a lot of things we can talk about in just the larger sphere of criticism, but also social politics and semiotics and things of this episode. It's pretty fun. But here's some of the things that Vanderwerf brought up. There's constant in all of these reviews saying that the episode is putting all of the blame on the women, in particular Mrs. Nesbitt. If she just let him do it with her, in other words, intercourse, none of this would have happened. But as the episode shifts the blame towards Art clumsily for not being able to consummate the relationship, Karen's character becomes more and more unbelievable. She's never turned to anyone about this? Question mark. She's never tried to get Art into counseling? Question mark. She's never realized how deep his depravity is? The cliche of the serial killer is that he's a family man and a good neighbor, so that no one could have seen what he did coming, but Art is clearly a loner type figure that giving him a wife who's either a sexless ice queen or ultimately an idiot irreparably harms the episode. In a lot of these reviews, this same thing is happening, which is that they are arguing that the show is painting Nesbitt, and to some degree Maureen, but especially Mrs. Nesbitt, as being the cause or some degree of responsibility for either Mr. Nesbitt's crimes or that she is an unbelievable idiot. So if we can maybe start talking about this, and that I could not fathom how they got this reading. And some of the claims he's making here I find to be really offensive when she's clearly painted, in my opinion, as an abuse victim. Art is monitoring where she can go, who she talks to, what she does. He's the one who's controlling it. At no point is she not willing to communicate or engage. She's also, I mean, there's all these ideas, but she's either an ice queen or an idiot. And I'm wondering, when you watched the episode, did you take that away? Do you think that the episode, the writer is, or the director, is actually portraying her in that way?
I think whoever wrote that probably should seek out some counseling. No, I just did not get that at all. That's I think that's coming from potentially a personal place with that specific person. No, I didn't get that. I think I would like to see more of Art Nesbitt's sort of not necessarily his day-to-day goings-on kind of thing, but I would like to see more of their relationship, at what is hinted at. I don't think he's... I wouldn't say he's necessarily... She has I don't want to say a kept woman vibe about her, but it kind of feels like her entire life is him and this kind of just middle America house that they've got together kind of thing. And it's one of the show does a very good job at kind of consistently throughout the seasons of there's a lot of sort of parodies of about idyllic American life, which for us British is a little bit sort of on the nose. It's kind of particularly obvious, kind of like what conventions it's trying to invert, sort of thing. Like with Frank and Catherine, you've got this, you know, this large wooden house, this yellow house. You'll never see a yellow house in the UK. Absolutely never. But that's kind of like this idyllic American family vibe kind of thing that he goes back to. This with the Nesbitt family is kind of a weird subversion of it, where everything kind of looks perfect. There's a breakfast scene, he's got a reputable job, she's kind of looked after, you know, everything kind of almost in a parody of the almost like the 50s nuclear family kind of way, but obviously there's some aspects of that missing, i.e. the two children, for obvious reasons. Because I was able to sort of lock onto that, I could kind of figure out what their relationship was. So no, I don't see her as an abuse victim as such. I see her just kind of like they've got themselves into a situation where neither of them is communicating properly. He has issues and she's just kind of stuck in the mud, almost, I guess. And he just sort of spirals off in his own direction without ever talking to the woman properly, without ever kind of getting any help, ever sort of looking at himself to see if there's something wrong. And obviously he sort of projects it onto other people, or the people die, sort of thing. And his attempt to fix things is just essentially to start again, kill a load of ravers. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I guess maybe I could be extrapolating too much from it, but I find the behavior very controlling and limiting her social sphere. Just even the imagery of how she's dressed, the way he's very chaste, and then the way the curtains are. She has to pull the car into the garage and close it. There's a lot of gaslighting could be that, but it's not just that. There is creating an environment of fear. So I don't mean abuse in the sense of violence, of physical violence, but in the sense of emotional and psychological control and manipulation.
Yeah.
Even in the sense of why he is not physically intimate and not communicating that. And just the fact that the reviewers are assuming that this person in this situation would go get counseling or get help has probably not met many abuse victims and understanding how this actually works. You bring up another point, which I'd love to explore, and that's one of the issues I think where I blame the episode's direction and the editing the most is that, like you mentioned, I would like to see more of the interactions. I would like to have had more time between Maureen and Detective Thomas and Frank. Instead, the director wastes half of the episode with these pointless POV shots. We don't need to see these stylized De Palma-esque killer scenes over and over again. Or just cut it down to 15 seconds, like something like Blood Relatives would do. Keep it tight. It's a complete waste. And then in the end, because everything's so tight, it comes across like it's a sledgehammer when it doesn't necessarily have to.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. It's kind of the classic filmmaker mentality in a lot of senses. Like, we've built this set, therefore it must be used to justify its cost. And likewise, we've filled a room full of ravers, and we've given them all costumes, we should keep going back to this place, sort of thing. And because of that, we're missing out on a lot of stuff. I think after, we should probably never have gone back to that club. We should have moved on to the swingers party and then moved on to something else. And that would have, it would have just quickened the pace a little bit, just giving you a little bit more breathing room to sort of have the Nesbitt household just sort of come to fruition, kind of thing. And I'm a big fan of establishing geography in movies and TV series. I like to know where people can be, where they are. And so when people are in kind of like, there's a chase in a house sort of thing, you know where people are. Whereas in this, you know, because they didn't give themselves enough time, there's a secret bunker. Oh, he's literally upstairs. Everyone's downstairs, but he's upstairs trying to have sex with his wife. And he's been really loud about it. And no one knows this because they didn't set up the fact that there's a bunker early enough, kind of thing. It's just a load of really dark sequences with a guy with a Polaroid camera, and there's some kind of watered down Nine Inch Nails in the background. It's too much style trying to just pad out what I think when they were in the edit session was just like, this isn't that good. Let's fill it.
Good points. And I agree with the space issue and the rest. In episode like this, I don't know if they're trying to repeat what happened with Well-Worn Locke, but we're dealing with a lot of similar subject matter, but instead of actually facing it head on, like Well-Worn Locke did, which there's a lot of critics of that episode too who say it's too on the nose. Yeah, it may be on the nose, but it's viscerally, like you mentioned, very effective. And it communicates it emotionally. And that's what is, I think, really important. And here, that's what we should have been spending the time doing, is connecting more with the characters and less of the style. Because the subject matter is like most money. But I think this is, in some ways, the relationship between, or just Thomas himself, and then the relationship between Mr. and Mrs. Nesbitt, is this is something that just needs time. And it did not get it.
Yeah, it the relationship angle didn't hook me that much. I know that when I'm checking on IMDb, because I recognize someone from the show, and then I have to check which episode of Stargate they were actually in, that I'm not that hooked.
Not a good sign, yes. Well, maybe next, how about we talk about, because you mentioned it, is Detective Thomas and the character there, and you mentioned some legitimate criticisms. Well, why don't you expand a little bit about how you think, what are some of the successes and or failures, or how plays in with the rest of the plot?
Yeah. To be honest, he's just this bizarre blunt instrument that's introduced early doors. And you get a lot of episodes where kind of, there's a lot of characters that kind of get introduced to Frank and aren't interested in getting on board with his way of thinking and looking at things. And that they often call him out and stuff. And, you know, there's so many times where Lance Henriksen, I just want to know what his I told you so face would look like. But obviously he's an absolute rock when it comes to that stony face. But this guy is probably all of the previous sort of overweight trench coat detectives just sort of rolled into this giant angry sushi ball that is... every opportunity he gets, he's just mad about something. And he kind of moves from scene to scene, just getting more and more aggressive. And it's kind of like, I know it's the 90s and stuff, but I'm pretty sure he would have been fired by that point. It's just not a way to go on, I don't think. Yeah, there's just kind of too much. And I think Lance Henriksen does a good job of showing that character-wise, they are polar opposites to some degree. And I think there's a nice moment later on, which is directed not great, but the actors are trying to make a go of it, is where they're in kind of a diner or a cafe together. And Thomas is kind of reconciling with him to some degree. There's an apology there, but it's not worded so simply. And then it's just kind of goes straight into this bolted on, this woman that I'm threatened by and intimidated by, do you think she's single? And it's like, where are we going with this? Why we had something quite nice almost there, where this hard-as-nails, hard-boiled detective, after vomiting exposition onto the dashboard, just then is like, yo, so is she single, kind of thing. Clumsy writing, I would say.
I do think that scene is a highlight of the episode in a lot of ways. But I had a different interpretation than that. It is still clumsy. I do understand that that's a valid interpretation about the transition to him wanting to ask Detective Murphy out on a date. There's a lot of reviews who criticize the episode saying Maureen Murphy. Yeah, so that she's just there to provide as like a savior fixture for Thomas. In the sense of, that at the end he can conquest, ask her out on a date. I did not get that at all. My reading, I could be wrong, that's why we're here to chat, and I can take the blows. Throughout the episode, they're patient, but he is infuriating. And what I think they were going for, if I'm going to be devil's advocate for man, is that similar to Nesbitt, Nesbitt is sort of permanently self-repressed. He has not developed psychologically, sexually, emotionally, and that has turned him into this complete ball of rage and sort of like a proto-incel. Thomas, on the other hand, went from a marriage and then through trauma regressed back to this point. And yeah. that asking out on a date scene, how I interpreted it, because where I disagree with the reviewers completely is there's no chance that the episode is implying that she's actually going to go out with him. There's no way that that is going to happen.
I'm instead
taking it that it's a sign of him basically. Yes, he has this moment, but he's still immature. He has a lot to grow and a lot to deal with. To me, it just looked like it's reinforcing. It's dialing it back after he had that, I think, very knowing recognition of his trauma and being able to open up, that it's not like, oh, I'm cured. I'm still a teenager. I still am very out of touch. So I kind of looked at it as a pathetic moment as opposed to the other thing, but it's still very uncomfortable, and it was not directed well to sell it that way.
Yeah. I think what they're going for is ultimately that they're trying to play off his sort of trauma and damage and Art's sort of issues. And it's an episode that feels like it's about sort of opposite people dealing with the same situation, which I guess is literally what it is, and how Frank then bounces off Thomas sort of thing, because those are opposites. But the way it came across when they're having this conversation in the car, I don't know whether it's intentional. Like you say, it's a pathetic moment, but to the point where it's kind of funny. It's almost two cops on a stakeout, and Frank is obviously paying attention to what is needed for the job and the task at hand, and he's just kind of looking through this rainy car window wishing he was somewhere else other than with this absolute infant in the car, and it's just the play between them both, I just found it a genuine audible chuckle came out, I'm afraid.
I think it's supposed to, though. I don't think that's a wrong interpretation for it, and again, I'm ascribing things that the writer may not have, mm-hmm. but he is repeatedly, in kind of humorous ways, shown to be a complete buffoon. And mm-hmm. at that point, Frank is just bearing patience. And you described it wonderfully about Frank's expression of, oh my God, what am I dealing with? And there's so many moments at this point. It's like, whatever. But I think Frank can see, he's patient and can see it. But so I think the fact that it's funny, whether they intended it or not, is a completely justified reaction. Whether it's a good funny or a hurts the script funny, who knows? Yeah.
I like the idea that, because obviously Frank is, it's all about the empathy and the perception with him. I just love the idea that, you know, the way he sees through the eyes of the killer kind of thing, when he's put up against these almost infantile, cliched, boisterous, trench coat copper guys, you know, does he sort of think the same thing, or is he just like, you are so basic?
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering here, reading into the text, that especially some of the scenes when they find the sex toys in the car and the way Frank reacts to that, just of like, what are you talking about? How is that relevant? Somebody just died here. And you're giggling about that. There's almost anger and judgment as opposed to just the exasperation later. That's something that would be fun to get your opinion on, is a lot of the reviewers state that the whole discussion about him being sexist with Maureen is very pat and trite, and the way Frank responds is, of course, Frank has to. On one hand, I agree, going back to the point that they don't have enough time to flush it out, so it mm-hmm. has to be blunt. And that's unfortunate. But my flip side, which I'm going to propose to you, is what's the alternative? If I'm going to play devil's advocate again, mm-hmm. if we have a character here who's already, we're talking about sexual crimes, we're talking about, to quite a strong degree, I think there's a misogynistic angle to both of the characters, obviously for mm-hmm. Thomas, but I think Nesbitt too, I think it's pretty clear. If it's only him and the cops are portrayed as if this doesn't exist in that space, mm-hmm. I don't think that's a healthy ethical position to take. And that kind of goes back to the well-worn lock mm-hmm. and the idea of, I think it's better there because they have to focus it, but this issue of toxic masculinity, if you'll give the word, I bring it up so many times, but I think that's really what season one is dealing with. And we're mm-hmm. talking about wounded people not being able to express trauma, not being able to reach out for help, sexual dysfunction. Just to isolate it and then make it be this monolithic demon that is the bad guy, I think would be irresponsible. And mm-hmm. it's necessary to have a protagonist, even if they're an antagonistic protagonist, be shown to be dealing with these issues too. The problem is there isn't enough time to make it something that's really meaty. But considering how pedantic it is and considering how limited it is, I think the fact the way Henriksen plays off of it is exceptional. And also the actress who plays Maureen Murphy as well. They could easily make this super, super preachy, like, you can't say that about a woman. Are you nuts? Come on, man. Instead, it's just Frank, just this nice, smooth dismissal, talking down to him in a polite way. But still, it's like, this is something that needs to be engaged on this level. This is the way it's often probably going to be encountered and dealt with in real life. I don't know. There's a few different things there. What are your thoughts?
How it could be handled differently, do you mean?
Yeah, well, could it have been handled differently considering the time, and should they have dropped the entire Thomas arc? My argument is, I think the failure goes a little bit to the script, but mostly to the direction, and not having enough time and the way that it's somewhat overplayed. But on the flip side, I praise the way Henriksen and Maureen underplay it to counterpoint it, and I think that it's actually necessary to explore it on those multiple levels as opposed to just, here's the villain on its own, and this is a myopic...
Yeah. My angle with Thomas would be he does have a dysfunctional relationship as well, but I would include his wife or complete family in the picture. And it would be something, I don't want to say mundane, but obviously it would be something less severe than what is going on in the Nesbitt household. Maybe because he hinted that, you know, his work did make things difficult and stressful, and he just couldn't understand physical relationships anymore. If we could bring that into the now, so to speak, and maybe his marriage has broken down to the point where he's staying in motels kind of thing, and if we could have a bit of insight from that into his life, you know, through these new traumas that he experiences, you know, finding essentially dead partygoers and confronting the Nesbitts in their house, I would like to see somehow, obviously this could, I can't articulate this very well because in the short amount of time we've got, but if we could see his damage and his relationship actually repaired to some sort of wholesome degree, I guess, like he just sort of fixes it, acknowledges he has problems, or the relationship in general has problems, and he fixes it kind of thing as a reaction to the Nesbitt sort of relationship breaking down. I think that would be the way to go, and it would be probably a more mature way of handling it, and it would give us essentially two resolutions, one upbeat, one sort of downbeat. I think that is how I would handle it. Yeah.
I think that's a good point. I wonder if they maybe had to avoid that. I doubt they did, but because of Dead Letters, which sort of did that angle with the cop that time, because his family was involved and it was the problem. And at the end, he kind of exploded, although that was a downer ending for him. But so they could do it this time and have a happy ending. Oh, but that's an interesting take.
I hate Dead Letters so very much.
Why?
I just think... The character that is introduced, I can't remember his name. What's he called? His kid's called Top Cat. We decided his kid was called Top Cat because we didn't know what TC stood for. And that was kind of some of the only enjoyment we got out of the episode.
James Morrison, Jim Horn. Yeah,
that's it,
yeah.
Jim Horn, yeah. And basically his character just grinds that episode to an absolute halt. There's so much interesting stuff going on, especially when you're establishing your universe and your tone and textures at the start of a, you know, it's episode 3 essentially, literally, and he kind of comes in and I get that he's there to represent how bad things could have got if Frank let the darkness just swallow him up kind of thing. But man, there's that barbecue scene with the kids and the dog playing in the background, and then, like we were saying earlier with the look on Frank's face when he's stuck with people that he just doesn't want to be with, like the look on Catherine's face is like, I want to go play with that dog, but I'm stuck between these two just nightmarish tectonic plates of misery. And it just, the speed and pace of that episode, Jim Horn is just such a drippy character. Like a wet flannel. I don't know if there was a British saying. Just stop me if you don't understand what I'm saying.
No, that totally... I mean, wet flannel translates well. I'm in Seattle.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Yeah, cool. I just found him such a... There's half an hour in that show that is pretty good, solid stuff, and there's 15 minutes that we just keep coming back to that's like, oh, please, just, dude, shut up.
I couldn't agree more. I love so much of the direction of that episode. I mean, it's another Thomas J. Wright one, and it looks fabulous. But it's tough because I see, like you said, why they were doing it plot-wise. Mm-hmm. I understand. And I don't think he's a bad actor, but I don't think he fits. I think it's a casting issue to where it's just too far. Every time, like, I'm on the edge, I'm going to burn out. And at least with Thomas in this episode, there's a little bit of humor in there. That episode is just unrelenting. Like you said, misery, but it's that over-the-top gritted teeth acted like, Frank, you don't know what it's like. I'm just, like, we don't need that for that long. It's already too dark. And I don't hate the episode. Because I like a lot of the other things that are happening. So see the direction, I won't argue. He is, the character is a real anchor. Or a wet flannel, as I learned tonight. One of the other things that's talked about is an argument a lot of critics take to disparage it, potentially justify, we're here to explore it, is that the episode is anti-sex. It's very puritanical. Mm-hmm. In that the swingers are attacked, a profile, the ravers. Mm-hmm. I don't see that at all because they're the victims. And I don't understand why critics are assuming that we're supposed to identify with the killer. And why are they identifying with the killer when even Frank Black, I mean, the episode kind of that thing I mentioned about like the sex toys or the swingers thing, and the Thomas makes a joke about it, and Frank is like, what are you talking about? Shut up. You know, these people died. They're humans. They're victims. And yet still there is this idea that the episode is making this very preachy or puritanical claim, which I also see a lot of critics slam. One thing that I hear over and over again, that the show is very puritanical and sexless. My rebuttal is, you've got 45, 50 minutes. After watching somebody be eviscerated, you want to see Frank Black and Catherine go back and have sex like it's HBO? We're not in the same world, especially in the 90s. Why would that be appropriate for the text here? And in that, so I'm going off on a tangent, but before I get to the follow-up question of this, what are your thoughts about that potential issue?
I think what people are completely missing is that the view of the only real puritanical relationship in the episode is perceived overtly negatively and basically leads to the guy becoming a spree serial killer. I don't understand. I think a lot of, especially with the swingers and stuff like that, again, it's quite lighthearted stuff. And what Millennium does quite well that a lot of shows didn't manage to do was to sort of, for the first time on primetime TV, was unearth what would be classed as taboo subcultures, and it kind of shows them kind of full frame what happens sort of thing. Like, I'll admit there's only so many things that they can show kind of thing. The rave sequence feels extremely sanitized, but it does what it can sort of thing. And again, with the Swingers Club, it's all very sort of safe and sanitized and almost kind of lighthearted, and it's certainly not an anti-sex episode. I don't think the intention is ever to comment on that as such, and I don't think it kind of sticks its oar in a sense of saying what is healthy, what is not healthy, outside of the Nesbitt side of things. But obviously that is a completely sort of sexless world as it is, so I think again that is reviews getting it completely wrong, the wrong direction entirely.
I will echo that, and I don't just understand that they can watch the episode where they find the victims and there's these ball gag or something, and the character makes a joke and Frank says, why is that a big deal? It's not a big deal. Why do you care? It's their right to do whatever they want to do, and that's our protagonist saying that, but yet many of the critics and reviewers I read are seeming to take the idea that the show is presenting the killer's view. One thing I liked about that I think that did interesting with the direction is that they're showing this objectified, sexualized version through the killer's eyes of these scenes. So whether it's the ravers or the hypersexualized swingers, and then you see them as normal people when they're dead. And it kind of gets rid of the gloss, or when the kids, the ravers, are victims, and the drugs are wearing off, and that, and it really humanizes it. I don't understand how that is. Oh, you do drugs, you deserve to die. I don't know where they get that connection. It kind of goes back to the pilot, and that right out of the gate, I think it's very brave of the show to open up and say, oh, here, it's a very disturbing, horrifying scene, but we're going to have a sex worker get killed. But before we do that, we're going to clarify that this woman is a parent and a human, and she's had concerns about this thing, and she's not just, oh, she got killed because she's a sex worker. And then later, of course, the men that he's cruising for and torturing, it's not like, oh, they got killed because they're cruising this guy. Is doing it because the killer is the problem. The killer's repressed sexuality. I find it weird that so many people, and I'm not trying to create this imaginary thing out there, but I keep encountering these views that they take Millennium as this anti-sex or anti-sex outside of marriage view, when so many of the killers, their problem is that they're repressed. The problem is that they're not able to communicate or engage in any healthy level. And it's an interesting litmus Rorschach test, I find. So that gets me to the main question I had for you, which is the major plot point. I've always thought it's so shocking and horrible. The show episode is anti-pornography. And that I read this in more than one review, that reason the episode makes that the killer's the killer is because he was hiding, one of the big factors, so the big surprise, he was hiding pornography from his wife. My God. As opposed to the fact that it's clearly written, this is where I think a direction could have highlighted it more, but they say it. This is a magazine that he has kept from 18 years before they were married. What could this possibly represent? What could this be a totem for? But no, I don't know if you had any thoughts about any of that.
They don't sort of... They just don't really comment on what the issues with the magazine are, or the greater issues at large of what the magazine says about sex and sex culture. Like, the big deal that they make about it is that it is in a waterproof Ziploc bag taped to the underside of the bathroom, and his wife just never expected to see that kind of thing. But her reaction is... It's all in the face, and you can read into it in many ways, but I don't think... She's not shocked that it's a porn mag. She's just kind of shocked that she wouldn't expect that from her husband, because he's just like a sexless thing. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't...
It's totally that as well. Yeah, I totally agree.
It just doesn't say anything on the issue other than your marriage isn't great. And we already knew that. And we already know that he has issues. And regardless of pornography existing for better or worse, he's still drugging and killing people under his garage in a magic bomb shelter that connects to the top floor of his house. So, no, again, I don't... When are these... the review that you're pulling from, when is that written, by the way?
Pretty recently.
Okay.
And that's where I think it comes to this modern context that people are looking at it through. And I was actually going to quote, there's an article I was going to bring, but I think we're running out of time. But just to kind of refer it to people, it's called It's All Over by Justin Smith. I don't know if you read it. It was on The Point. And I'll just read a small snippet of it. Is the idea of talking about the meme of those bingo cards that you can assign to a group, like a men's rights activist or a feminist, evergreen, or, you know, whatever you want to do, hippie. And the idea, so it's the idea within this grid, there is an exhaustive, as if it were a priori tabulation, deduced like Kant's categories of the understanding of all the possible moves a member of these groups might make. And whenever the poor sap tries to state his or her reconsidered view, his opponent need only pull out the table, point to the corresponding box, thus revealing to him that it is not actually a considered view at all, but only an algorithmically predictable bit of output from the particular program he is running. The sap is sapped of his subjectivity, of his belief that he is properly speaking, has views at all. So this is more about like modern art and ideology, but I thought it raised the point of where the reviewers are seeing these semiotics and they've heard these tropes. And if something is dangerous as what this episode is talking about, and we were talking about sexuality and throw out this word again, but toxic masculinity, we're talking about gender roles and oppression. It's such a loaded thing that the safe thing to do is to fall back and say it's wrong. to quote and to kind of get this goes back into a well-worn Locke and Murphy, mm-hmm. and then we'll wrap it up here. Darren Mooney, in his review, he wrote that Loin Like a Hunting Flame is the logical extrapolated endpoint of the show's, i.e. Millennium's, approach to female characters as objects in need of protection.
No, I don't think it's that simple. So to clarify, I'm not saying that all women in Millennium are victims, but that there are defined... It's not men and women. That's not how I kind of lay out where people sort of sit in the show. There's kind of... there's victims and there's antagonists and there's protagonists sort of thing, because the boundaries cross real fluid. Like, there's so many female characters that I've seen so far that have been active participants in moving narrative forward, in terms of resolving stories and narratives. There's women that are brought in as consultants to where Frank Black can't actually get a piece of something down on a piece of paper. Like, I need to find out, like, a forensics test. He brings in, I can't remember the character's name, Millennium Group, played by...
Cheryl Andrews?
Cheryl Andrews, that's the one, yeah.
CCH Pounder, yeah, she's so awesome, yeah.
She is awesome, yeah, yeah. Not a woman you would mess with. But again, it's characters like her. I can't remember the character. It's the one with the burning preachers. Oh, it's got number. It's the numbered name, isn't it? It's just numbers, I think.
No, that's Kaboom. You're thinking of Kingdom Come.
I am thinking of Kingdom Come, yes. Sorry, yeah.
No worries.
But yeah, again, Kingdom Come has a strong female detective character. It's hinted at that she's worked with Frank in the past. There's deep respect between them both. And again, that kind of relationship is set up in 25, 30 seconds. It's really fast work. And yeah, I just don't think it's as simple as saying Millennium says women and gays bad, men good. Yeah, it's just not that easy, I don't think, especially across the three seasons. It gets real complex.
And this will wrap back around to this episode, but just continue on what you're saying. I mean, we've got Murphy in this episode, which I want to go back to, but like Laura Means or Hollis or Catherine. Mm-hmm. And I think of Well-Worn Locke, Wild and the Innocent already in this episode. Those are all of the protagonists and the resolutions are there. And I guess where I'm trying to get at is Millennium is a show about serial killers, mostly men, and their dysfunction and trauma and violence, and who are often the victims of those, it's women.
Yeah.
Is because toxic men are a threat to women in reality. So the fact that there are, like in the pilot, the sex worker is killed, I don't see that as a way of, it's of course complicated, it could always be handled better, but I don't see how that is somehow a checkbox that Millennium is demeaning or saying women are powerless or that's the only role. Like you, all the examples you gave. And that kind of goes back to, let's look at this episode. How in this episode do we see women as being victims? We have Murphy and so many other people I've read criticize the episode that she's too strong and like a Mary Sue who's just there to be there for Thomas when she's just very capable, patient and strong and just doesn't give in to any of the BS. And then Ms. Nesbitt is, I think she's abused, but she also has agency and engages in communication and is open to sexuality in all of the ways that Mr. Nesbitt isn't. And I think that the show, the script does take an effort to make that distinction that she has agency even though she is abused and she is not the problem. But I don't know. What are your thoughts on all of that jumble of words?
Yeah, I think you're right with Mrs. Nesbitt. But like I was saying, I think she's just sort of in a situation and she doesn't really know how to get out of it because they are kind of that viewed as almost the idyllic American family and you've got a house and you've both got jobs. It's like, well, how do you get out of this easily enough? And potentially there is a, because of his sort of weird gaslighting stuff going on, it's kind of like, if I get away, then what happens? But I like the idea that with this and with Millennium as a whole, you've got Maureen Murphy. I think she's not an aggressive character. I just think she moves on with plot-driven dialogue and exposition in spite of just the stuff that is being thrown at her. Because she's not reciprocating just the antagonisms from Thomas, it's kind of viewed as aggressive when actually she just wants to crack on. I don't want to say the exact opposite and say that Millennium is this great sort of feminist icon sort of TV show, but I think there's a balance, which is, whereas obviously the toxic masculinity is a new term, but obviously you can retroactively apply it to a certain degree. And I think situations in Millennium and problems are resolved by essentially groups working together despite sexuality and gender, and any masculinity that gets the job done is patient and positive masculinity rather than anything toxic. There's nothing bad about the dudes that, like, save the day because they did it with intelligence, understanding, and patience, if that makes sense.
No, it totally does, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I actually like the way that Maureen's portrayal was done, because in the 90s we had a lot of preachy gender dynamic stuff, and there's a place for that and there's a role for it, but instead to just show, like, I don't need to sink to his level, I'm just going to do my job, I'm going to engage professionally, and Frank to step up, and that's kind of, it's Frank's job to be dealing with that guy and not and not her job. To be fair to Darren Mooney and then other critic for the Set the Tape, Hennedy, I hope I pronounced that correct, who also wrote, you know, a very good, interesting review, even though I'm disagreeing with some of these points. They do note that Millennium and this episode don't give the women characters a lot of time. And I can't argue that that is a problem. Even though the show's focus, I think, is on masculinity, that's not really an excuse to do it. And I think if they would have gotten rid of all those horrible POV shots that go on for so long in the rave club, like you mentioned, we could have given them a lot more time. And there isn't really an excuse not to ramp it up further. But it's not necessarily we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We can criticize it and say it's problematic. You can dislike it. You can think it's there. But I'm just not sure it's as evil as some folks think it is.
Yeah.
Since it is getting late, I do want to get one other take. Your thoughts on some of the set pieces. Some of them can be, I think, visually inventive, but one criticism I have is they don't make a lot of sense. And that goes back to the great point you made about space. We're talking about space. Like, how did he get in and stage the victims by himself in the museum or like the arboretum, wherever that was? Could he pull that off? And then some of the other things of getting them down into his garage or a lot of the stuff it's a bit cartoonish, which is, for me, a downside. But, say, Lovey, what are your thoughts?
The issue with the show so far is, I say it's the issue. The issue with this episode, contrasting with what the show has done so far, is that there's always kind of a sit-down session that discusses MO and it discusses psychology behind serial killers and serial killers far and wide, essentially. At no point does Frank just kind of sit down and explain to us why they're dressed as Adam and Eve. You can read into it and you can absolutely sort of figure it out by yourself and you can get a potential interpretation from it. But like you say, it's just so wildly ridiculous that they both, like, did he have one over each shoulder or something? Is that drug that he's cooking up at work like some sort of Captain America serum or something like that? I don't know.
PCP,
PCP, yeah. But it's just so, without sounding too harsh, it's nonsense.
Be harsh.
Yeah, it is nonsense. And again, when they open kind of the hatch at the bottom of the garage, which looks like it hasn't been used in a long time, so did he take these people into his house through his... did he pull a book on the bookshelf and the bookshelf rotated like a speakeasy and then he led them down through the shelter?
Exactly.
Or did he just chuck them down the hole sort of thing? I don't get just the raw physicality, the physics of it. It's trying to be real over the top, almost kind of supervillainish, just to get to the point where you can have a guy rotating around the room, turning dingy light bulbs on and taking grimy pictures sort of thing. It wants to do that, but it doesn't do the legwork necessary to do it. The setup for the set pieces isn't there. It would be like if a Jackie Chan film just started and he fell off a building and landed in a truck full of balloons and then the film just ended. Like, okay, fine. I that doesn't make any sense to me as someone that's not familiar with this world. I think the rave club, like I said, is already sort of a sanitized sort of... I felt like I was listening to the music from a really early sort of stock music, PlayStation 1 game, budget title sort of thing. Like, that's not what those people are listening to, guys. Come on. It's just, you've got that off a shelf. No one here has any idea what people under the age of 30 are actually doing on a Friday night. Come on. And the whole thing just has an air of unbelievability about it. And then when he tips up at the end and he's got syringes and he's sweating and he's trying to make love to his wife but also kill them both, it's like, well, how did we get here? Where are we?
Yeah. Yeah, that the pacing of that ending is just bonkers. It doesn't make any sense. And then he just becomes so cartoonishly crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh my gosh. I mean, this is a guy who's been able to gaslight his wife for 20 years and he can't he can't do
Yeah. And then but if we were to contrast that to, again, the well-worn lock, I know I keep going back to it, but it's such good episode.
Yeah.
You understand the geography of that house. They make a point of, like, patrolling the perimeter of the house, understanding where that room of abuse sort of faces on to the street sort of thing, the windows that close, the lock on the door, the downstairs, the kitchen. You know where everything is. You need to understand how that house functions, not just in the way of its family dynamics, but also physically where people are in the building at any given time, which this episode is 180 degrees. It's just the opposite. It just botches the finisher, to quote wrestling.
Yep. Which is sad now that you bring that up, because I haven't actually thought about space before. Yeah. It's a great point, but like Covenant, it's crucial. Sacrament, Lamentation, that is how they build the tension. That is how the plot is centered. It's necessary, and yeah, it totally falls apart in this episode. It's an excellent point.
It has done it in several other episodes. Like, well, my memory of Millennium as a whole is a little bit hazy, but on season one so far, I think we've had a few instances where it's kind of almost criminally sort of just overlooked to get to Deus Ex Machina, just to resolve it, wrap it up sort of thing. And like, to be fair, in Weeds as well, the fact that he's torturing young boys directly under a swimming pool in possibly the echoiest, loudest space possible.
Yeah.
Again, it's just doing it to just have that satisfying contrivance, almost, that it was directly under their noses in a place where he can just kind of pluck the young boys and take them downstairs kind of thing. It's convoluted, contrived to the point where it's silly.
Just trying to get set pieces. Yeah. After the pilot's like, oh, remember the great chase scene on the bridge? Can we do that? But we don't have any budget.
And I should probably do, like, if we are wrapping this up, I should probably comment on music, because that is my thing.
Do it. That's your, hit me.
In the vein of this episode, pretty bang average. I think there's a couple of, all the nice stuff seems to happen between sequences where people are transitioning either on foot or in vehicles. And you get that sort of typical, there's a bit of percussion, there's a simple bass line, and then there's Mark Snow's sort of token digital piano sound. And I've got a real soft spot for that stuff. It's not particularly inventive, but it brings me back to the world essentially of Chris Carter and Mark Snow. It's a nice little anchor point. And I kind of, it's moments like that in this episode that reminded me, oh no, I still do really enjoy this show. Yeah, that's great. But generally unremarkable, sadly.
I was hoping that'd be the highlight that pulls this up from a 3 for me, but I don't remember anything memorable from it, so I'm going to trust your judgment on that. As a final point, and then I'll turn it over to you for any final points, I will say, after all the discussions about clumsiness and everything else which is there, I will agree with one of the weak parts when it comes with the narrative is, I think at the end, it probably was shoehorned in there. You got to make it a little bit more doomy, gloomy, prophetic. Mm-hmm. They have to talk, Thomas and Frank, about, you know, sex and death and risk. Mm-hmm. And that undermines, I think, a lot of what the episode is trying to say and just falls flat, especially, I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to make it be the Millennium. It's that. Just that, to me, is the real weakest part of the episode. No, I don't know if that's fair, because there's a lot of weak parts. But it didn't land for me at all. And, in fact, the contradiction of what else was done before, it is kind of puritanical, and it doesn't really work. But I don't know if you had any thoughts on that.
Bolted on, like you were saying, just to be like, hey guys, just remember this is Millennium. Coming up next week is more grimy first person views and heroin junkies. Okay, we'll see you next time. And it's completely unnecessary, I think. I much prefer episodes where the resolution is sort of Frank going home and having a little bit of a back and forth with his wife. That's kind of what I like, because she's a much more stimulating character, not only to us but to him. And with this, it's kind of it feels like two pieces of furniture just trying to discuss philosophy. It feels like the director went, okay, we've got 20 minutes, bring that light over, Frank, just do you, and you just kind of do the opposite of what you've been doing, just kind of be more open and receptive. Cool, okay, action, go. It's just tacked on, and it's kind of a bit naff.
Perfect. I couldn't have said it any better. In fact, my mumbling thing, I'm going to retract and take that. It would have been a much better ending just to go, because they already had the discussion, mm-hmm. Frank and Thomas. They don't need to talk mm-hmm. anymore. They had the coffee shop discussion. Go home to Catherine. That would have been so much better. Ah, well, if we could time travel, I'd have you make that fix. Any final things you want to bring up before we wrap it up?
I don't really know. I think we've gone pretty in-depth, more in-depth than I thought we would have done, so that's cool. Yeah, considering it's kind of one of those episodes people sort of enjoy, well, like to put by the by and ultimately sort of forget about in the grander scheme of things. I think we've done what there is of it justice, so to speak, and probably made an interesting case for it, especially with 2019's sort of politics, sexual politics, things like that. And that, you know, at its core, it's still sort of aligned with the way the series as a whole sees politics, gender politics, and the world at large. And yeah, the reviews are just kind of, especially the recent reviews, are just really baffling to me. Yeah, that's generally my take on it. Yeah, I thought it was all right. I thought it was okay. It was just silly, and we can move on afterwards. It feels like weekly TV, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah. No, it totally does. Yeah. Yeah. And it ain't perfect. And just to listeners out there who find the episode offensive, that's fine. We're not offending it. We're not saying it should be taught in schools. Mm-hmm. Just trying to maybe explore some of the nuances, and that, I like you mentioned, I think it does. The episode, I think, is more interesting in the context of Millennium mm-hmm. and gender politics than the episode itself. Mm-hmm. I don't think the episode itself really has too much to say, but it's interesting because of how risky it is, and especially nowadays, but I think even back then it's a pretty risky episode mm-hmm. to take all of those positions. And I kind of give them kudos just to take those mm-hmm. risks, and that's why I like Millennium, is it does some crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. And when it works, that's great. Yeah. And when it doesn't, hey, at least they tried. Yeah. At least it's not just boring weekly television. It's boring for Millennium, but it's not like we're watching a really bad Murder, She Wrote episode or something. Yeah. If there are such a thing, I shouldn't judge Murder, She Wrote. I've actually never seen a whole episode, so it could be a fabulous show. To close it up, so you mentioned that you do music production, composition, mm-hmm. and all the rest. Do you have any projects that you can point listeners to, or a website, things, stuff that you're working on?
Ooh, many things. At the minute, my company, it's a small film company in York, England. And at the minute, we've got our heads under the bonnet developing a music app that is designed for tabletop role-playing, and it's kind of a music mood sound effects enhancer kind of thing. So it has 45 minutes of original virtual orchestra, but still orchestral music, 90 to 100 sound effects, a load of ambient beds and original artwork. And it's kind of based around, I guess, like late 90s PC games like Baldur's Gate, Icewind Dale, Diablo, things like that. So it's kind of, again, I'm firmly entrenched in the 90s, as you can kind of tell. It's that kind of thing. Movie-wise, there's a movie called Book of Monsters, which I wrapped on towards the end of last year, which had a limited theatrical run stateside, and I think a full Blu-ray release with Dread Central, who I'm sure you've heard of.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was, yeah, again, my Mark Snow influences came into that one kind of thing. If there's a room with people talking and it needs to be slightly more exciting, I break out the Kurzweil synths and the Yamahas, and I pretty much go into Mark Snow mode. I just play some string pads, and then I do a little bit of piano over the top with a little bit of percussion just to sort of tide it over. and at the minute, I'm doing a film which it's quite a hot topic over here. I'm sure you've probably heard of Brexit.
Well, you're going to jog my memory. Yeah. I've only hearing about it. The past 10 years, it seems like now.
So basically, the UK is attempting, in possibly one of the most bizarre political maneuvers we've ever seen. We're just kind of stood here like, what is going on? We're attempting to leave Europe, greater Europe in general, and we're kind of not that on board with it anymore. A lot of us weren't, and even less are on board with it now, but our government is going ahead with it.
So are you doing the soundtrack for when you march out of Brussels? Is that what the nation's going to watch?
I am segueing. So a friend of mine did a horror movie as a response to this. To kind of capture the zeitgeist almost, is a group of very middle-class British people who secede from the United Kingdom basically to found their own little tiny country, which is village-sized, because they like murdering people and they make murder legal within the town limits. So it's capturing the Brexit vibe, and that's the marketing angle for it. And that is a mockumentary horror comedy, which all of those things are hard to do. But this film, I think, gets it right.
Well, that sounds fun. That sounds fun. What kind of Swiss-style music are you going to do for that? Is it kind of like action-ish horror comedy, but mockumentary? It seems like you go a lot of different directions with the music.
I suppose if you guys have ever come across the Louis Theroux,
he's a
fantastic British export, and he's kind of a lot of people get him worldwide. And it's kind of that sort of pace, UK Channel 4 sort of vibe, where everything's played very straight and the comedy sort of comes from just how ludicrous the situations are. There's some slapstick moments. So I'm kind of doing... We have a TV show called The British Bake Off, which, again, is also a national treasure, where it's very cutesy. It's summertime Britain and people bake things and it's like a competition. And it has this really lovely sort of almost Vivaldian plinky plonky. Actually, no, when you build your house on The Sims, that is the kind of music you get. And that's the music I'm currently doing in the first half an hour whilst we're establishing characters, is this plinky plonky, stiff upper lip kind of music to contrast with what is being discussed, what is being talked about, and what is being shown. Kind of the way Dawn of the Dead does all that horrific stuff and has the cute mall music in the background is kind of the vibe that I'm trying to capture with this. Yeah.
Fun.
All kinds of fun.
All right. And it looks like the movie is called... There's two. There's The Book Club and Chesterberg. I see on IMDb. Is that the same film?
The Book Club was kind of like a proof of concept thing for a film festival. And the actual film is Chestersburg. Yes.
Oh, it is Chestersburg. Sorry, I misread that.
That's the full film that will be coming out soonish. It will be doing festival runs probably after summer. And there's a full trailer out for it, which features my first attempt at writing polka, which drove everyone in the studio completely insane because it took me so long to get it right.
People, if you just search for Dave S. Walker...
That's the one, yeah.
...on IMDb, there's a ton of stuff to check out. Been crazy prolific, so... God, must be fun. Must be fun.
Sir.
No, I am completely envious. It's like a dream job, and that's amazing. It's one of those dream jobs that seems like so much fun and incredible work. So I have an enormous amount of respect and jealousy.
I wouldn't be jealous of the paychecks.
That's fabulous. Do you have the last thing to ask? You don't have to, but do you have a Twitter or anything you want to share with people?
No, I have an Instagram, I guess, which is Downgrade Arcade, which is just kind of pictures of Laserdisc, which I suppose is relevant. Models that I paint, various candid photos of me taking pictures of my girlfriend eating food while she's not aware I'm taking a picture. It's kind of just like an everybody's nonsense Instagram. But if you like old tech retro stuff, then it's kind of a good one to follow, I guess.
Fabulous. It took much longer than I expected, but I had a lot of fun talking. I appreciate your patience. And thank you all for listening. And until next time.
This is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting the XCast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXCast. That's patreon.com/TheXCast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.